Hello, my name is Tristan Riddell.
And I'm Matt Hansen, and you're listening to the first episode of the new podcast, The Nerd Party.
Matt, talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
All right, as my co-host said, this is the first ever podcast of The Nerd Party. Now, just to give you a little background on what we're going to do here, this podcast is going to be about all things nerd. This is where we get together and talk about movies, TV shows, comics, technology, everything that you can think of that we personally geek out on. Matt, you have your own podcast already. What is that called?
Yes, I do another podcast. It's called The Delta Quadrant. You'll find that the common thread between Tristan and I is that we're both Star Trek fans, among being fans of many other nerd franchises. The Delta Quadrant is a Star Trek Voyager episode-by-episode review podcast on the TrekMate Network, and I've been doing that for the last 3 years.
And I am a host of another Star Trek podcast that just happens to be a Star Trek Voyager podcast, and that is To the Journey on the Trek.fm network. And that's actually, I mean, one of the reasons why we met is we met on Twitter and we're like, hey, we geek out on Star Trek and we have our own podcasts. This is kind of our first collaboration, as it were, doing our own podcast, because we've guested on other podcasts together. In the future, we will briefly talk about a few Star Trek things in here and there, but because we do a Star Trek podcast on our own, I think we're going to keep it to a minimum.
Yeah, this was sort of a project that we had talked about a long time because, like you said, we've been on other shows together and we get along very well. And this is sort of our, not that we don't like talking about Star Trek, because we wouldn't be co-hosts of Star Trek podcasts if we didn't. But this was, we wanted a project that would give us an out to talk about other franchises and other nerd properties, as it were.
For our first episode, we're going to talk about a movie that came out on July 11th, and that is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Now, I am an old fan of the original Planet of the Apes movies. I was raised on them. And Matt, now you just saw them recently, is that right?
Yes, I had seen the original 1968 movie long time ago, probably before I was old enough to really appreciate it. And the same thing with, I've seen bits and pieces of the 2001 Tim Burton remake. But other than that, I was watching the sequels in the original series for the first time. I had seen Rise in the theaters, and that kind of got me reintroduced to the series, but hadn't gone back and seen the original sequels until this run-up to Dawn.
Now, with this one, now, I'm so happy that both you and I saw it on opening night. Sadly, we didn't see it together, but that's a little bit of a problem of time and distance. Now, just so you know, guys, people listening at home, listening in your cars, this has spoilers. So if you're thinking that you're going to get a spoiler-free review in this podcast, you are absolutely wrong. I cannot stress this enough. Do not listen to this if you have not seen the movie. Again, spoilers are coming. Turn it off. Save it until you see the movie, because you absolutely should. All right, so Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. This was a very different movie from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Now, with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, James Franco was really the protagonist, or at least they tried to make James Franco a main protagonist, and I think they found out that audiences really attached to Caesar a bit more. Now, they kind of flip-flop back and forth, and they kind of took the duty of protagonist at the same time. But with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, there was no question as to who the protagonist was, and that was definitely Caesar. All human characters were absolutely secondary. Now, what were your first reactions to the movie, Matt?
Okay, so I saw this at 7:30 on Friday night, large format screen, 3D, sizable audience. So I took in the movie for the first viewing and was completely blown away. Now, I am someone that Tristan knows is subject to the recency effect and hyperbole. But I really was affected by this film in a way that I haven't been affected by a film for a long time, in my opinion. So I went again yesterday, Saturday the 12th, to kind of do another screening. Okay, now that I know what the story is going to be, let's actually pay attention to the movie itself. And again, I was just completely blown away by this movie. So I loved it. That's my short review.
You're no stranger to going back to the theater and rewatching movies. I very rarely go to the theater and see a movie. I'm a huge renter, like digital renting, you know, just going on iTunes or Vudu. You know, I have a home theater set up and I love it. And I can't stand people talking or, you know, texting in the theater. But you go to the theater a lot. How many times have you seen Captain America 2 in the theaters?
You're really going to make me do this on air, huh?
I want a number. I want everybody to know how many times.
I took the day off of work the next day so I could go to the midnight premiere. And saw it then, loved it, and subsequently returned 6 more times, I think. So I think I've seen Captain America in theaters 7 times.
That's 7 times, people listening at home. That's 7 times. I have never, ever gone to a movie 7 times in the theaters before. Not even close. I think the most was 3, and that was Star Trek 2009. That was the most I ever saw a movie.
That's my record. That was 8 times that summer.
Oh my gosh. 2009 was your record of 8?
Yes.
Holy crap. All right, so I'll probably see Dawn maybe one more time if I'm lucky. I'd like to take some friends to it maybe and just kind of share the experience, share the love. This format was very, very much different from Rise because Caesar is already established. He's already the leader. Like, Rise ended with Caesar rising to power. We saw that he's already intelligent. He has a whole bunch of other intelligent apes with him. And the Rise of the Planet of the Apes ended with that post-credit sequence of the pilot bleeding, you know, from the nose in the airport. And then we see that graphic of the travel lines of the simian flu just kind of going all over the world. And we're like, oh, holy crap. So this is how the human race dies. This is how we get wiped out, or mostly get wiped out. And Dawn picked it right up with that graphic where we see the world and we get kind of a catch-up of what happened via news channels and via radio transmissions. And there was a 1 in 10 survival rate. And then we get some exposition from the apes. We see Caesar talk with Maurice, the orangutan that we met in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And Maurice goes, well, this whole thing started 10 winters ago and we haven't seen humans for the past 2. So, you know, I wonder what'll happen. And then what happened is they see some humans next. So what did you think about the whole exposition process of the film, like with the beginning, with the characters talking, all that?
The thing that I loved is exactly what you pointed out, how Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the credit sequence was the graphic of the virus spreading around the world. And I just loved how this movie opened up with that exact same graphic. I almost wonder if it's the same kind of footage, except with the new news reports thrown in. But I thought it was just such wonderful symmetry to it. It really feels like part 2 of a continuing story. And I thought the exposition is such a tricky thing in films because it has to be there to service the plot. But then again, it has to also not feel clunky and out of place. So I thought the way that they did it in this film was pretty expertly done for a summer blockbuster.
I think so, too. I think you put it right. I think you put it accurately there, is that I always give a big eye roll whenever I'm like, oh, yeah, it's Captain Exposition coming. You know, like it's always very obvious in movies. I haven't seen too many movies where it's subtle. But for a summer blockbuster, with that in mind, I thought this was very integral to the plot. And yeah, it was obvious, but at the same time, it was necessary, especially since it was a sequel.
Not only is it a sequel, but I believe the time difference in between the two films is supposed to be 10 years later. So that's 10 years of catching up that we have to do in the course of about 20 minutes, I think, is the exposition period of this movie. But or maybe even 10 minutes, because they run into the first human carver really quickly.
That's true. They do run into it very, very quickly because... at the beginning, we see Caesar and he's with his tribe and they're on a hunting trip and they're going after all of this what looks like caribou. I think we see his fully grown son, which is named Blue Eyes, which was fun to have kind of that reference to the Planet of the Apes, Charlton Heston's, like that's what Mira and Cornelius called Charlton Heston's character.
Was Bright Eyes.
Was Bright Eyes. And so I kind of was just like, Blue Eyes, Bright Eyes, you know.
But it's also a reference to Rise of the Planet of the Apes, in that if you remember from that film, the characteristic of the smart apes was that the virus turned all their eyes green.
Yes, absolutely.
The fact that this ape's eyes are blue eyes.
Right. It's like we have the green flex, you know, from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. We have Bright Eyes from Planet of the Apes. And so we have this new Blue Eyes, which kind of makes you think, okay, is this a new generation? Is he going to pass the torch? You know, like, you know, what's going on with this character? And we actually see a bear attack at the beginning. And so they already established right off the bat that Blue Eyes has a hard time following his father's authority. He has a lot of issues with paying attention or not being so headstrong. And so they establish characteristics right off the bat, because Caesar's the wise father, knows what's best. The son doesn't want to pay attention. He's strong, but he doesn't want to pay attention. He doesn't want to learn right off the bat. And then Koba is violent and strong and fierce and actually saves Caesar's butt. So there's that strong friendship there. And so they just did a lot of character developing and establishing right off the bat, which I thoroughly appreciated. But then, you know, the humans come in and they're wandering in. We find out that this is the first time that humans really understand that the apes are intelligent.
And that, you know, I thought that was kind of strange at first, but then I had just seen Rise in the rewatch going up to Dawn. And really, no one heard Caesar talk except for Tom Felton, the other people at the ape prison, as it were, and James Franco, and all those people are dead now, or so it's implied. Right. So no one else knows that they can talk. They just know that they attacked.
I'm sure people just thought, oh, the apes went crazy, and so they just, like, you know, attacked everybody on the Golden Gate Bridge and then escaped to the Redwoods. And then basically civilization collapsed. And so they didn't have to worry about the apes in the Redwoods anymore because they had bigger problems. But that was kind of a shocker to me a little bit, because with San Francisco and the Redwoods just so close to each other, I mean, like, you can see the city from Caesar's village, and the apes didn't know that the humans were in San Francisco, and the humans in San Francisco didn't know the apes were in the Redwoods. How did you feel about that? Did you think that was a little far-fetched? What did you think?
No, not at all, because I thought it fit into the psychology of where everyone was coming from. The apes specifically went into the Redwoods at the end of Rise to get away from human beings. So they had no desire to make contact with them over the years. And the humans, as we learn in between films, had much more bigger issues to deal with than wondering where did the apes go. So, you know, as their civilization's collapsing, I don't think they're going to be too concerned about some escaped crazy apes in the Redwoods. So I thought it made sense why there was no contact.
All right. Yeah, I was, at first I was just like, really? I mean, they're not going to see each other, but then they probably could have just had, like, skirmishes here and there. Like they might have just, like, seen a couple people, a couple of bands here and there, kind of like in The Walking Dead, where you don't see too many large groups of people anymore. It's really just bands here and there scattered out. Now, once they make contact, we realize that the humans actually are held up in San Francisco. They have their own little community going, and they're using, it looks like, gasoline for power. And they're, you know, getting gasoline from random cars throughout the city and just, you know, gathering it where they can. And they say, okay, we're almost out of fuel. We're going to be out of fuel in 2, maybe 3 weeks. Gary Oldman's the leader. And then we have Malcolm come in, who is the lead human, who is played by Jason Clarke. And I think he's a fantastic actor. I'm really excited to see where his career is going to go.
Well, I kind of know where his career is going to go, Tristan, because I do believe, if I'm not mistaken, he's going to play John Connor in Terminator Genesis next year.
I forgot that. That's amazing.
So we will be seeing him again next summer.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have an episode on the Terminator franchise as well. So that's really cool, because I remember seeing him in Zero Dark Thirty, and I was very impressed with his skill and his he brought gravitas to the movie without bringing arrogance. The producers needed somebody you felt like you could trust, who wasn't full of BS, but also had this vulnerability where he really just wanted to do the right thing. Malcolm and Gary Oldman are friends. They're, you know, it's none of this pig-headedness that you think that you would see in the trailer. You know, you think that Gary Oldman would just be this crazed madman who just hated everything and was just going to kill the apes and you know, it just didn't care. But the thing is that they did such a good job of crafting everybody's character that you had no idea who the real antagonist was until 3/4 into the movie, and still we started getting to the rising action. And it was just so great because everybody was doing what they thought was best. And so the Malcolm and these characters were like, okay, the dam over in the Redwoods is what we need. This is the only way that we're going to be able to continue to get power to this city so that we cannot be savages like we were a couple of years ago. And so Malcolm goes and tries to negotiate peace with Caesar, you know, so that they can work on the dam.
And this is after the fact that they've had the initial encounter, which I just want to say was so impressive because we all heard Caesar talk in the last movie. No one can forget the no scene from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. But when you hear him with the humans for their first time, where he does the go, it was almost like hearing him talk for the first time again. I kind of like jumped in my seat because I wasn't expecting him to scream like that.
Yeah.
But we're also just wanted to point out that Malcolm is going back to talk to Caesar after Caesar has marched into their stronghold and said, "You guys stay on your side. We'll stay on our side. Don't you ever come back."
I thought this was and thank you. I absolutely forgot to mention that. Yes, I thought this was a good scene because this established at how well of a warrior / negotiator / leader Caesar is because he has these people on both sides of his village saying like, we need to stay away. No, we need to fight them. And so he found a perfect way to establish dominance, show that they're fierce, but yet at the same time, avoid a war. So he took his army in force right up to their gate and say, if you want to fight, you'll get one, but I don't want one. You stay on your side, we'll stay on ours. And they show that they were intelligent. They show that they're an army to be reckoned with, but yet they don't want war and all they want is peace. And that is a fantastic sign of a leader.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you said, after that, that's when Malcolm goes up and tries to negotiate peace so that they can work on the dam. A lot of crap happens where, like Koba's like, I'm not ready for this. Like, I don't think the humans should be trusted. And they shouldn't be because Gary Oldman said, okay, Malcolm, if you cannot go up there and convince them within 3 days to let us work on the dam, I'm going to kill everybody so that we can take the dam because human life is more important to me than apes. And so at that time, you're just kind of like, okay, that's kind of extreme, but think about everything that they've been through. So it's not like he's necessarily that evil of a person, but he's scared.
No, and that's what I love about this movie is that when we get to talking about the real quote-unquote antagonists of the film, no one in this film to me is truly evil because I see everybody doing things for motivations that they firmly believe in. And those are kind of, to me, the best sort of villains, quote-unquote, if you want to call them.
One thing that there was an interview that Willem Dafoe had a long time ago, and I can't remember for what film he was promoting, but it was a very long time ago, and the interviewer said, who do you like playing more, the hero or the villain? And Willem Dafoe said, it doesn't matter. Everybody thinks they're righteous. And I just thought, I just got chills all over when he said that, because I just thought that was so great and so well put, because everybody is the hero of their own story. Everyone thinks they're doing what is best for their people, for their tribe, for their species. And this was absolutely true. You had Gary Oldman, who was the leader of this entire band of humans, who just wanted power to keep the lights on and keep everybody warm and fed. You had Malcolm, who wanted to make sure that there wasn't war and no human life was cost, and that the apes gave the apes a chance. You had Caesar, who just wanted his home. He said, he's like, let's just keep the apes and the humans separate. Let's not risk any lives. And then you had Koba, who also wanted to save apes' lives, but by preemptively striking the humans. And so you have you have two humans and two apes who all want the same thing, but in four very different ways. Actually, maybe three very different ways.
Right.
And it's just, this was a well-crafted movie for that reason, because it wasn't just like, even though like I'm a huge Star Wars fan, right when Darth Vader walks on to the ship, the rebel ship, you're like, that's the bad guy. That's the villain of the story. We can now move on. Luke Skywalker, is the good guy. Princess Leia is the good princess. Darth Vader's the bad guy, and the Empire's bad, blah, blah, blah. Rebels good, Empire bad. We didn't get that feeling with this movie.
No, we certainly did not. We have the inkling, of course, as moviegoers, that the people that we're probably going to be able to latch on to most are Caesar and Malcolm. because yes. they seem like they're the most principled, if you want to call them that, of all of our main characters. But other than that, it's totally left to ambiguity. And it's so he eventually does secure permission from Caesar to come work on the dam for the human camp. But on the condition that no weapon.
Everybody but one person kind of followed that rule. And that's the same person who shot an ape at the beginning of the film and thankfully just grazed him. But apparently he was the only person who had like damn expertise. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay. And so like they caught him with a shotgun and they're like, this person threatened Caesar's newborn child, which we saw the birth of this child in the movie. And so Caesar just wanted to throw him out right then and there. He wanted to throw the humans out. He's like, okay, that's it. I said no weapons. You disobeyed me. And so go screw yourselves. But Caesar's wife or mate was having a hard time after birth. And so Malcolm's wife or mate or whatever you want to call her, lady friend.
Felicity.
Felicity. Carrie Russell, who was fantastic, by the way, and it was great to see her again. She was a member of the CDC, and so she had medical expertise. She helped the wife get better, and so thus gained them another day of work at the dam, and they actually got the lights going, but not before Koba secretly went into San Francisco and saw them gearing up for war with their weapon cache.
It should be mentioned, it grants them one more day at the camp, provided, and Caesar says... the apes will help, because Malcolm's like, I don't know if we could do it in a day. No, you have one day. I'm not giving you any more than one day, but the apes will help you.
Right. And then, you know, like, Koba sees the weapon cache, gets freaked out. He's like, they're gearing up for war. Koba saw what was really going on. He didn't lie. He didn't stretch the truth. They were gearing up for war. They had enough weapons to wipe out the entire village. And so Koba came back and said to Caesar, this is what's going on. But then he sees apes helping humans. Apes are working for humans. Koba was trapped in a cage most of his life. He cannot stand for this amazing scene. And I hope that you registered with it as well as I did. Like, Koba starts yelling at Caesar, and Caesar says, no, we're helping with the humans' work. And Koba points to his scars.
Human work.
He starts pointing to his scars on his head, human work, on his arm, human work, and on his chest, this is human work. I've had enough of human work. And he just starts raising his voice at Caesar, and that's when we have that epic scene where we got a little glimpse of it in the trailer where he says, Caesar loves humans more than he loves apes. And that's when just Caesar just lost it and beat the crap out of Koba.
Well, he lost it, but lost it in a way that I think it's appropriate for a leader to use it, because we find out later in this movie that apes will follow strong apes. And right. Here, Caesar's authority is being questioned by one of his top aides, as it were. So he still needs to establish that, no, I'm still in charge.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He needed to establish dominance because it's the ape way. He needed to. Up to this point, Koba was constantly... questioning Caesar. He was constantly questioning his authority, questioning his orders. Caesar had to knock him down a few pegs, and in this time he beat him up, and we see him bloody on his face. And this was the turning point for Koba.
Yes.
Like, this was where we saw a little switch go off in his brain where he's like, okay, if Caesar's not going to protect himself, I will protect Caesar from himself. Slowly we start seeing Koba become the real antagonist for the film.
Yeah, he's the instigator, and not only does he not start, he stops trusting Caesar at that point, he actually starts preying on the doubts that Blue Eyes, his son, is having. Because Blue Eyes was present at the first encounter with humans when Ash, the other ape, was shot. Not killed, but shot. So Blue Eyes has been disenfranchised with his father's point of view this whole movie, and Koba preys on that at this point.
I thought this was, as I said before, this is master storytelling, because this is all, this has elements of so many Shakespearean plays and so many coups in history where we see so many political figures who have right-hand men or aides or people who they trust, and they work behind the scenes to develop situations to throw them out of power. And so what, like, they fix the dam, they turn the lights back on, you know, Caesar and Malcolm create a friendship. They have a trust. They even say trust to each other.
They're having somewhat of a celebration that evening. And we had just seen this. I didn't pick up on this until my second viewing, which is why I was so happy to go back yesterday. When Koba's talking to Blue Eyes before the project is done, he says, "I fear for your father's life. Keep Caesar safe while the humans are around." So I didn't realize what was happening until I knew what the story was. But he's planting the seeds of, or he's sowing the seeds of doubt in Blue Eyes' head, because what happens later in the movie is going to make Blue Eyes think back to that conversation and think, oh, the humans did what happened later.
Koba takes a human gun and shoots Caesar, and it's in the shoulder near the heart. So we don't quite know, you know, we don't quite know what's going on. Like, was it a mortal wound? Was it not? We all could figure, obviously, we didn't see a body. We didn't have a death scene. So obviously he's not going to be really dead, but he shoots Caesar. Caesar falls down into the bushes. Blue Eyes comes up, takes his mother to safety. Koba finds the gun, or Koba and Blue Eyes find the gun. And they, like, Koba also sets the village on fire and says, "Humans burned our house down. Humans killed Caesar. We're going to go and burn their house down." And so then the humans who were there, Malcolm and Felicity, they go and run away. And then all the apes mount on their horses, and then they run towards San Francisco. And this is that moment that you saw in the trailer. This was at nighttime, where you see Gary Oldman with an M16, and you see all the apes on horses with their own M16s.
Come on, the image of the film is Koba on horseback with two machine gun rifles firing them off.
And then having his horse jump through the fire in slow motion. My wife, who I saw the film with, almost got up and started clapping when she saw Koba ride through the fire with two machine guns on horseback.
It was so cool. I couldn't believe it.
When I saw the trailer, I thought that was going to be the climax of the film, but it's not. And also, they started playing, like, you know, like weird music, and it was a little bit in slow motion in parts. And so you're like, which way is this going to go? Are the apes going to win, or are they going to get their ass kicked? And I didn't know which way it was going to go while I was watching it.
And that's so cool that you say that, because you and I, and I'm going to call myself a Planet of the Apes fan now, because this series has completely won me over. But you and I know, as Planet of the Apes fan, exactly who's going to win in this prolonged battle. We know the outcome from the 1968 movie. The fact that it can get us to question this is a feat of genius, quite frankly.
And also, you and I are obsessed with movies. We watch movies all the time. We love movies. We analyze movies. We talk to friends about our movies. And so you and I have a pretty good sense of how the process of storytelling goes, and the structure of storytelling. Thank you. The structure of a script, how the hero wins. And so it's, I don't get too surprised in movies, but I had no idea where this was going to go. I thought, okay, maybe like Gary Oldman and his people will just obliterate Koba and his people. They'll go back to the village with their tail between their legs, even though apes don't have tails. And then Caesar will have to defend his rabble against Gary Oldman, who follow them into the woods. But what happens is they actually win. They take over San Francisco and they put the humans in cages. Yeah. It's insane.
It's a great callback to the original Apes movies, where we see humans in cages all the time. And correct me if I'm wrong, the other thing that I loved about this movie is Michael Giacchino's beautiful, beautiful score throughout this whole thing. Also, too, if I'm not mistaken, and again, not as big on versed on Planet of the Apes as you are, I thought I heard some of Jerry Goldsmith's cues in there from the original film.
I think that was the only time we heard a little bit of it. I feel like in that battle, at the nighttime battle with lots of fire and Koba on horseback, I feel like we got just a little bit. I feel like we just got some drones of Jerry Goldsmith, just a few notes here and there. But I'm glad that you brought up the music, because let's go on a segue a little bit. So you liked the score. I immediately did not like it.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was emotional. My favorite point in the score, actually, is there's a scene coming up later that I sure will talk about, where Caesar ends up going back to the home of James Franco from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's been abandoned. Mm-hmm. There's a point where he's going up into the attic and he hits a couple of notes on the piano as he's walking by. And Giacchino expertly takes those two notes that Caesar just hit and weaves it into the part of the score that's scoring the scene. And I thought that's such great composing work that I just I have to commend the man. It complemented the scene so well.
You are right. I mean, that scene was quite good, and it was those little things that were quite good, and him taking a few things from Jerry Goldsmith in the nighttime battle, and then having those emotional swells when we were at James Franco's house. I did mention to my wife, I said, okay, I didn't like the music, but it did get better as the film went on. During the first couple of scenes, at the first half of the movie, I was like, what are we listening to? Who wrote this score? It was just, it felt very out of place. It didn't feel like it matched the movie very well, in my opinion. And I was just very dissatisfied with it. But once that scene happened with the battle, and then everything that followed, all of the emotion and all of the action and all of the like the peaks and valleys, I thought were fantastic towards the latter part of the film. So it felt like two people scored it to me.
Well, the thing was, I personally was won over right away by the score from the opening frame, because after the studio logos and all that, when we get the graphic of the simian flu going across, it's just this very simple, somber piano score over all these horrific, horrific images. And I think that when you show images that are so powerful, I mean, the instinct, I think, would be is to do this sort of bombastic action score, especially even during the action scenes where, you know, it does get a little bit more rousing. But then with that opening credit scene, and then when there's points in the battle where the sound of the gunfire all cuts out and all you hear is the score, it's not an action score, it's this somber piano theme. And I think that it underlines the fact for me that it was so simple that it added so much emotional weight to it. And I think that's why I was able to go along with the score. I'm definitely going to get this on CD.
Well, I think I'll definitely have to give it another listen, because you've convinced me to pay closer attention and to give it another chance. Speaking of the emotional rise of the battles and everything of that nature, there was a scene where Koba is sacking San Francisco, where you immediately see him get drunk with power. I mean, almost as soon as Caesar's dead and he takes San Francisco, you see him just completely disregard the values that Caesar established. And there's this amazing scene, absolutely amazing scene, where a human takes a pole and just starts to weave it back and forth and try to get the apes away from him and his wife, trying to defend people from basically killing him.
Yeah, so he's swinging around this pole, and it's fending off the apes in front of them. Koba comes up behind him, takes the pole from him, and he's holding the pole, and Ash is right there, who is the ape that got shot at the beginning. And so Koba hands the pole to Ash, and he says, here, you kill them, Ash, make humans pay. And Ash ends up dropping the pole and saying, this isn't what Caesar would have wanted. So he doesn't kill them. And so Koba, what I loved about Koba in this film is I didn't know what he was going to do until he actually started doing things. Because he kind of walks up to him and puts his arm around him like he's giving him a pat on the back. That's kind of what it looked like to me. It looked like a companion sort of hold. And then all of a sudden he just grabs Ash from behind, yanks him up the stairs, and throws him off the ledge to make an example of him.
He throws him off the ledge, and they're like three or four stories up or something like that.
Oh, yeah, it kills him. Ash is dead. And, you know, Koba just turns to the rest of them and says, Caesar is gone.
When Ash puts down the pole and says, no, I'm not going to do it, this is not what Caesar wants, I threw my hands in the air. I was like, yeah, that's right. You know, like, Caesar's the leader, not Koba. And it's just, you feel this swell of emotion of pride. But then out of nowhere, as you said, Koba establishes dominance by throwing Ash over the side. And then we see the look on Blue Eyes' face, who I commend this the digital artist as well as the performer. He gives so much emotion in his face, specifically in that moment.
This is the turning point for Blue Eyes, because when Koba does this, Blue Eyes has kind of been loyal to Koba this whole time. And then when Koba does this, he breaks the ape sacred commandment of ape does not kill ape.
This was a common theme in Planet of the Apes, like from Planet of the Apes all the way through up until Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where ape does not kill another ape. This has been a theme in every single movie. Koba obliterated that. He was the first one to break that rule, and that's a big deal. And so, like you said, Blue Eyes is like, I screwed up. I backed the wrong horse.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when we see Blue Eyes go to, or like see all of the people who were too loyal to Caesar chained up by Koba, like the humans, and how the just like the humans did to Koba in that bus. After that scene, we see that Malcolm and Kerry Russell and Malcolm's kid, they find Caesar. He's shot, but he's alive. And so they take him to James Franco's house because Caesar takes him there, and they stay there and for refuge for a couple of days.
The problem being is that by the time they find Caesar, he's lost so much blood. Kerry Russell has to operate on him but has no more supply. So Malcolm has to go back and sneak into the village, which is already occupied by the apes at this point, and get her surgical kit, which he manages to do. But he runs into Blue Eyes, who you think for a second, because Blue Eyes still thinks that no matter what Koba did, they killed his father. His father is dead still, as far as to his knowledge. And there's that moment where he lowers the gun at Malcolm and you think he actually might do it. And he puts it down, having just had the experience with Koba throwing Ash off. And that's when Malcolm gets to tell him, your father is still alive.
And I just want to say that that scene where Malcolm tries to get back into San Francisco and works his way into his apartment building was very Children of Men-esque, where it was a long Steadicam shot where the camera follows Malcolm throughout the apartment. And this, we see apes firing weapons, we see humans escaping and screaming, and it was just very tense and very cool, very well directed. And then he takes Blue Eyes back to the house, and that's when we see this kind of reconciliation between Caesar and Blue Eyes. And what did you think of that scene? Did you think that it was well deserved, well earned? I had a sense of catharsis when I saw the two of them get back together.
I am not ashamed to say the two scenes, because there's two of them. There's one pre-op and there's one post-op at when Caesar's recovering.
Right.
Both scenes, I'm not ashamed to say I started crying.
You got a little misty, huh?
I did. I thought it was very well earned. And the thing is, Blue Eyes doesn't speak throughout a lot of the movie. And this is the first scene where we actually see him speaking quite a bit. And, you know, he's saying, you know, I'm so sorry, Father. I should have never done this. And he says, no, it's my fault. I chose to trust Koba because he was ape. And my favorite whole line of the whole film comes right here in the scene where Caesar says, I used to think... I trusted Koba because I used to think that apes were better than humans, but I see now that we are more alike.
We've been summarizing and giving our opinions a lot, and we've been going on for a while. And so let's just cut to the chase for the end. Towards the end of the film, they take Caesar back to San Francisco, and they release all of the loyalists to Caesar from the bus. And there was a turning point where the loyal apes were fighting against the disloyal apes, and some of the humans were escaping from San Francisco. They released them from the cages, and then Malcolm takes them to the tower where Koba and his people are staying. And then Malcolm goes underneath the tower and sees that Gary Oldman is just going to blow it to hell with C4. I want to talk about this moment because Malcolm goes along with it for a little bit, and he's like, Gary Oldman says, he's like, we made contact with another group of humans from the north. They're gonna be here soon. We're gonna destroy this tower and kill all the apes all at once by blowing it up. And Malcolm's like, oh, okay. And you see him, he's conflicted. He didn't know what to do because he just led Caesar, who is now his friend, up to the tower. But then Malcolm takes one of the guns and turns it on Gary Oldman and a few of the other people there, and says, he's like, no, you got to give him a chance. Caesar's going to try to work it out. You know, he's going to try to convince Koba to stop. He's going to usurp his throne back. And Gary Oldman's like, what the hell are you talking about? What did you think about this moment? Because I was kind of on Gary Oldman's side here.
The thing is, I could see where both people were coming from. And that's the thing I love, is that everybody's motivations rang true to me. You say that Malcolm kind of went along with it. I didn't take it so much that he was going along with it at first. I thought he was thinking in his head. What I interpreted was he's thinking in his head, crap, how am I going to stall this guy? How am I going to stall this guy? Because, you know, he's already established the relationship with Caesar at this point. Caesar is his ally. So I think he wants him to succeed. So it just comes to the point where it's like, well, I'm going to have to turn the gun on him. There's no other way to stall him. But everybody's motivation was fine. It was perfectly understandable. Malcolm's was understandable, and so was Gary Oldman's, which is why I think, you know, I'm kind of with everyone in this scene.
It's just like, look at it from Gary Oldman's perspective. Malcolm says, oh, the apes have a civil war going on, and we should just give them a chance. As Gary Oldman, I completely see him justified as going, who the hell cares? We're talking about the survival of the human race, and you're going to let me just, like, trust some ape that I don't know? Just say, like, oh, yeah, I'll give them a chance. Let's see if they those two crazy kids can work it out.
Well, the thing he says is that, you know, they're animals. They attacked us. We didn't start the war. They attacked us.
Yeah, so. And he's right. They did. He has no, he doesn't know the difference between Koba and Caesar. The apes attacked them. And so Gary Oldman is going to like, okay, all right, if war is what you want, then war is what you'll get. I'm going to blow it up. And then we see Gary Oldman just in an act of desperation says, okay,
yeah,
I'm going to save the human race. And then he explodes the C4. Malcolm somehow gets away.
It's very, very Beneath the Planet of the Apes-esque. Self-detonating a bomb.
Yes, absolutely. I felt like that was kind of the closest thing that we got to a callback with the whole self-detonating. I felt like there could have been a whole lot more callbacks, but we'll get back to that. Yeah, and so the C4, like, you can see that, you know, like, it wasn't like one of those demolitions in Las Vegas where it just, like, brings down the whole house. And I like that because it's not like they're professionals and it's not like they had a lot of it. And so the C4 detonated at the base of the tower, but it didn't topple it. And all the while Caesar and Koba are fighting at the top, and they establish that Koba just doesn't care about his other apes. All he wants to do is kill Caesar. And then we have this epic moment where Caesar is actually winning. So it kind of ends on this whole Star Trek 3
Lion King-esque,
versus...
if you will.
Yeah, Lion King, Star Trek 3, you know, Kirk and the Klingon, where you know, Koba's hanging on by a rafter, and Caesar's pulling him up. And for a second, you're thinking, oh, you know, like, is Caesar going to save Koba because an ape doesn't kill another ape?
Well, Caesar pulls him up at first because Koba says to him, ape, not kill ape. So it looks like Caesar's going to be the bigger, I was going to say the bigger man, but the bigger ape.
The bigger ape.
But he has probably what will probably be one of my favorite lines from the film. And it's a line that I texted back to you when you texted me that the ape shall not kill ape line that night, which is he just looks Koba straight in the eye and says, you are not ape, and lets him go.
And lets him go and lets him fall. Now, I want to talk about this moment. Now, this is the climax of the film. This is a defining moment for Caesar. This was reminiscent of the Man of Steel moment where Superman kills Zod by breaking his neck. Now, Zod is killing people, and so Superman had to do something. And in this one, Koba was disregarding all ape life and usurped his throne, tried to kill him, and there's no way that he could trust, there's no way that Caesar could trust Koba again. But at the same time, I am thinking, I don't know if I like that. I don't know if I like the idea of Caesar breaking his own rule.
No, I you know what? I went along with it because I felt the moment that you're comparing it to in Man of Steel felt very unearned. It felt like we need to end the battle scene. And quite frankly, the people that Zod was putting in danger could have easily escaped. I mean, that scene has always bothered me for that reason. Here, it seals the deal for me when Koba tries to trick him with the ape, not kill ape line. Because Caesar's already been told at this point by Blue Eyes that Koba's killed Ash. Throwing him off the ledge and that sort of stuff. So I think it's justified because Koba has already broken the commandment. And ape has never killed another ape before until Koba. So, you know, apes have never had to deal with, I guess, what could be considered a capital crime in their society. Caesar no longer views him as his brother, as his compatriot. He's no better to him than the humans who tortured him. Back in Rise.
I think it's funny that you put it that way, because I think that was how I justified it in my brain, is that this is the first time they had to deal with it, and Caesar said, we're more like humans than I originally thought earlier in the film, and with it, this is very human, where we as humans say, we don't kill people unless you kill people. you know, like, we're not going to kill anybody unless you've killed people in the past, and that's what Koba did, and so that's what Caesar felt like he had to do. And then, you know, Malcolm and Caesar share a moment where, you know, war's already started. There's nothing they can do to stop it. He tells Malcolm that he needs to run away with his family. It feels like with Caesar's home burned to the ground that they're going to establish their own village, maybe within the bounds of San Francisco, or they're waiting for those other humans from the north to come, who knows what they're coming with. And so that was the end of the movie, where Caesar just has his legion of apes begging for forgiveness for what they did previously with linking up with Koba. And so Caesar is leader again, but he has a new challenge to face, and thus sets up the third movie. Now, one thing that I want to say real quick before we get into a quick retrospective is I hate setup movies. I can't stand it when a movie is in the middle of a franchise or even at the beginning of one and you're like, oh God, this is just a setup movie for the third one. This is just a setup movie for the second one. There was no payoff. This sucked. I am emotionally robbed from a good movie. I did not get this feeling from this film. This was a great standalone film that easily set up a third one.
See, that doesn't bother me so much if the film's been good up to that point. You know what I mean? Like, I've felt emotionally invested. I am with all of these characters. But you're right. It feels very different compared to some of the other placeholder films, if you will. It definitely feels like the middle chapter of a franchise. As a matter of fact, a lot of the early reviews I saw for this film, which were glowing, by the way, but a lot of the early reviews I saw this film were comparing it to The Empire Strikes Back, in that it's a sequel that not only bests its predecessor in their opinion, but also leaves it on a cliffhanger, and not necessarily a bright cliffhanger, because they're at war now. Nothing's good. Nothing's resolved. I mean, Koba's dead. That part of it's resolved.
Right.
But the war's not over.
I like that. I like that, comparing that to Empire Strikes Back, because Empire Strikes Back is a fantastic film and it's a great standalone film, but you're like, there's a lot of stuff that's going to continue on in the third one, and I can't wait to see the third one. And that's how you feel with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, is that you cannot wait for the third one, but at the same time, you're like, that was solid storytelling, that was a solid movie, and this was not a waste of my time.
Absolutely not. And before we move on to the retrospective, I just want to give full props to not only everybody who worked behind the scenes on this film, because this film looks amazing. Matt Reeves, the director, made it look grand. I mean, no matter what you thought of the music that accompanied the early shots, when you get that establishing shot of the ape village, it's beautiful. And I love how the film ends as it begins, because the first thing you see after the graphic is the pullout from Caesar's face. The last thing you see before the end credits is you zoom back in on Caesar's eyes. So expertly directed. But I also want to give major shout outs to the eight performers, and specifically Andy Serkis, who I'm now a major fan of. I loved him in Rise, but he really won me over in this film. So big props to him. But I also do want to give a shout out to Toby Kebbell, who took over the role of Koba from the last film, because he was not Koba in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. This is a new actor portraying Koba, and he was fantastic.
Yeah, Koba was phenomenal. Blue Eyes was fantastic. I mean, every single actor, whether they were digitally represented or not, did just a fantastic job and a solid performance all around. With this film, I'm immediately going to buy it when it comes out.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
I cannot wait to watch it again. And I'm going to watch Rise as soon as we're done with this podcast. And I'm going to go through with another Planet of the Apes rewatch. So on a scale from 1 to 10 apes, how would you catalog this movie? 1 being horrible, 10 being one of the best movies you've ever seen.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Yes, I'm subject to hyperbole, but I can't help it. I love it when I'm kind of the anti-hipster, if you will. I love franchise films. I get involved in the hype leading up to the next installment of whatever franchise it is. It's just part of the joy of me going to the movies. This is why I go opening day to the theaters, because I want that experience of seeing it for the first time with an audience. For Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I will say that watching the original series and all the films that came before made me appreciate and enjoy the Planet of the Apes. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes has ensured that I will be a Planet of the Apes fan for life. 10 apes out of 10.
10 apes. Wow, fantastic. I'm very picky with my movies. I like what I like, and I don't like what I don't like. I just, some people say I'm a snob. Some people say I'm just I'm too invested. I analyze too much. I love this film, but as I was walking out of the theater, I was like, do I like it more than Rise? I'm not quite sure. You know, like, Rise had a lot of great moments. I loved Rise. Rise was a surprise hit. No one knew that Rise was going to be as good as it was. Everyone just thought it was just going to be like, oh, okay, so it's another remake. We tried that in 2001 with Tim Burton, and it didn't quite work, so whatever. We'll see what happens here. But it was, everybody loved it. It was fantastic. And with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, everybody had high expectations because Rise was so fantastic. But as I was walking out, I was like, I don't know if I like this one more than Rise, and I was expecting to like it more. But I felt that way with a lot of other franchise films. Like, when I saw The Dark Knight, that's the perfect comic book movie, in my opinion. But then for a very long time, I was like, I don't know, I kind of like Batman Begins better. But then as I watched it more and more, I was like, you know what? You know, The Dark Knight's better. And so I feel like this is going to happen with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, where I'm going to watch it a couple more times, and I'm going to be like, you know what? Yeah, this has a few more moments that I like more than Rise. So right now, I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. Not because I dislike anything, but just because I need to give it a few more watches, and 10 is like a perfect movie for me. So I'm going to say 8 just because I was in love with it, but there was a few things where I was like, I don't know.
The thing I'm going to say to you is that I think for me, seeing it a second time this weekend helped me a lot in terms of my feelings for the movie. But I think that this film is going to have a lot of rewatch value. And I think when you pair it, when you're able to get the DVD of, or the Blu-ray of Dawn, and watch Rise and Dawn back to back, I think you're going to like it a lot more. And I think I would say that I completely agree with you that no one thought Rise was going to be a hit. But I also think that even though there were high expectations for Dawn, I don't think anyone thought Dawn was going to be this good, because sequels rarely live up to their original. And this was one of the few times where a lot of people felt, including myself, that it not only met the original, but it ended up surpassing it and digging out its own niche within the franchise as a whole. So I'll be interested to see what you think of when you rewatch this film.
All right, Matt. Well, that was our review, our spoiler-filled review on Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. We gave you a summary. We took you scene by scene and talked about what we liked, what we didn't like. And overall, we both loved it. And even though I gave it an 8 and you gave it a 10, I feel like there's some middle ground there where it's still a fantastic movie. We cannot oversell this. Go see it again if you've seen it already. Hopefully you've seen it already, because otherwise, what the hell are you doing listening to us? But what we're going to do is next week, for episode 2 of The Nerd Party, is we're going to do a complete retrospective of the original Planet of the Apes films and how Rise of the Planet of the Apes as well as Dawn fits into that timeline. Now, we are working on getting a website hooked up so you can go to us and talk to us. But right now, probably the easiest way to talk to us is on Twitter. Matt, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter. My handle is at mhansen0207, and Hansen is spelled H-A-N-S-E-N.
And you can find me at The Insane Robin. And please tune in next week, and please talk to us about all things nerdy, and please join the nerd party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.